least three women, Ridge went on, all of them known employees of the so-called Gentlemen's Club in Culpeper County. Those women are Caroline Cross, Catherine Tenancourt, Renata Cruz. Surveillance photos that I'd seen before went by in a slideshow. And this is Sally Ann Perry. A video started up, and right away, I recognized the recording I'd handed over to Cormorant just the other day. Like Ridge had said, the Secret Service appreciated MPD's participation. There's nothing pleasant about having to watch this, Ridge said, but you should know who we're going after. The man about to come into the bedroom is Constantine Bowie, and he's about to commit murder. Chapter 100. Everyone held their professional cool as the video played out, and Agent Ridge kept talking as it did. A little history here. Bowie was recruited from Philadelphia PD into the service in 1988. For 13 years, there's not much to tell, but shortly after 9/11, his performance started to slip. Then in February of 2002, after an improper firearm discharge, which I'm not going to detail this morning, Bowie was removed from the service without benefits. Cormorant took it from there and brought up a slide of a generic-looking office building. In 2005, he opened Galveston Security here in D.C. Galveston? Someone asked. His hometown, Cormorant said. Today, he's got satellite offices in Philadelphia and Dallas with a personal net worth of $7 million, give or take. The Philly ties don't prove anything, but it's worth noting that at least some contract work with the Martino crime family out of Philadelphia has been a part of this whole picture as well. Cormorant's eyes traveled over to me before he went on. One other thing we can tell you is that phone records show two calls from Bowie's cell to the one found in Remy Williams' cabin today. One of those calls was made 2 months ago, and the other was 4 days ago. Where's Bowie now? One of the agents asked. Surveillance puts him at home, as of 2300 hours last night. We have half a dozen agents watching his house.
How soon can we move on this?
Someone else asked. You could feel the impatience in the room. No one wanted to tackle the operation, I think, so much as they wanted to get it over with. Agent Ridge looked at his watch.
We go as soon as you're ready, he said,
and everyone started to stand up. Chapter 101. It was eerily quiet when we pulled up to a row of flat-topped brick townhouses on Winfield Lane in Northwest. One pair of tennis players was added on the Georgetown courts across the road, and the playing fields were still wet. If Nana were home, I thought, she'd just be getting up and ready for church. We had four SWAT officers posted in back, with MPD cruisers at either end of the block and EMS on standby. The rest of us emerged onto the street several doors away from Bowie's place, where a single white van was just coming to a stop. Once Ridge gave the go, an entry team of five men in ballistic gear exited the van and snaked up the front steps of Bowie's townhouse in a line. It was a silent operation. They pried the door and then disappeared inside. After that, it was 10 long minutes of waiting while they leapfrogged through the house, clearing one space after another. Ridge kept his head down and a hand over his earpiece as the SWAT commander whispered their progress to him. He held up two fingers to indicate they'd reached the second floor, and a few minutes later, three fingers. Then he straightened up suddenly. I could hear shouting coming from the house.
They've got him, Ridge said,
but then,
wait!
There was some fast back and forth now, with Ridge blurting communications.
Yes, I hear you. Do not stand down.
Eventually, he said,
okay, give me 1 second, and turned to address the rest of us. We've got a standoff situation inside, he said. Bowie's armed and belligerent, says he won't talk to Secret Service.
I didn't have to think about this.
Let me talk to him, I said. Ridge held up a finger and went back to the mic in his cuff. Peters, I'm going to send in a throw phone. No, I said. Face to face. All he's looking at in there is five armed officers. We're not window dressing, Ridge. You brought us here for a reason, and now we know what it is. There was another long stretch of back and forth after that, relayed among Ridge, SWAT, and Constantine Bowie inside. Eventually, an agreement was reached. Bowie would let them check the rest of the house to make sure no one else was there, and then I'd go in. All of a sudden, someone was handing me a vest, and Ridge was giving me the rundown. Keep SWAT between you and Bowie at all times. If you can get him to stand down, do it, and if not, leave. Don't drag it out. He checked his watch again. 15 minutes. That's it, and then I'm going to pull you out myself. Chapter 102. The profiler in me was working overtime as I entered the alcove of Bowie's townhouse by myself. The place was airy and well-appointed inside. A large amount of cash had gone into early American antiques and art. It was also extremely neat, not a loose magazine, newspaper, or stray knick-knack in sight. I saw a lot of control at work in this house. Was this where Zeus lived? Had he murdered here as well? The master bedroom was at the top of the stairs on the third floor. Two SWAT officers in the hall nodded at me as I came up, but they didn't say anything. I could also see two of the three who were inside the bedroom, covering Bowie from different angles with their MP5s. I called out to Bowie. Bowie, my name's Alex Cross. I'm with MPD, and I'm coming in, okay? There was a pause. And then a strained voice. Come in. Let me see a shield. He was sitting flat on the floor, wearing just boxers, sweating profusely. The king-size bed had obviously been slept in, and the nightstand drawer was hanging open. He'd cornered himself under a window, between the bed and one of the two closets. His arms were locked out in front of him with a .357 Sig Sauer pointed at the nearest officer. The other thing I noticed was the signet ring on his right hand, gold with a red stone, just like the one in the video we'd all seen by now. Man, he was making this too easy. Why? Was he Zeus? I kept my own hands in front of me with my badge showing, and only came as far as the doorway. Everyone else stayed still as statues. Nice house, I said right off. How long have you lived here? What? Bowie's eyes took me in for half a second, then went back to his target. I was wondering how long you've lived here. That's all. Breaking the ice. He scoffed. Checking my mental acuity? That's right. I've been here 2 years. The President of the United States is Margaret Vance. 7 times 8 is 56, okay? So I guess you understand the gravity of what you're doing, I told him. That's where you're wrong, he said. I have no fucking clue what's going on here. Well, then I'll tell you. I'll try to anyway. Technically, you're under arrest for the murder of Sally Ann Perry. His eyes flashed anger without actually moving. Fuck that. They've been gunning for me ever since I got pushed out. Who has? The service, the feds, goddamn President Vance for all I know. I stopped and took a breath, hoping he'd do the same. You're giving me mixed signals here, Bowie, I said. 1 second you seem lucid, and the next, yeah, well, just 'cause I'm paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get me, right? Oddly enough, I couldn't argue with that, so I moved on. Why don't you tell me what you need to hear before you lower that weapon? He chinned at the officer closest to him. They put theirs down first. Come on, Constantine. That's not going to happen, and you know it isn't. Work with me here. If you really are innocent, then I'm on your side. Where did you get that ring? Stop with the questions. Just stop. Okay. His arms were all muscle, but after at least 20 minutes outstretched, they were starting to shake. And in fact, he moved to adjust himself up onto one knee with the shooting arm resting on top. "Bowie, I..." A tinkle of glass sounded. That was all it was. One of the small window panes behind him split into shards, and Bowie fell face down onto the carpet, a small dark hole in the back of his head. I couldn't believe it. Didn't want to believe it. Immediately, SWAT flew into action. Someone pulled me backward into the hall while the rest closed in around Bowie. "One round fired. Subject is down. We need medical up here right away." A few seconds later, I'd pushed my way back into the room. My body was shaking with rage. Why had they fired on him? Why now? I had him talking. Bowie was splayed on the ground, arms out at his sides. Through the broken window, I could see another officer on the opposite roof, standing down with his rifle. "Scratch that medical," the commander was saying. "We'll meet you downstairs and bring you up." And then two of them were walking me out the door and down the stairs in no uncertain terms. My usefulness had obviously played itself out here. When we got to the front stoop, the EMTs were waiting. It was protocol to call them in, but at this point, that's all it was. I'd already seen enough to know that Constantine Bowie was as dead as he was going to get, and that I had just been bait in the whole damn thing. They had meant to kill him all along, whoever they were. Chapter 103. It all seemed too neat, too easy, but that didn't mean Constantine Bowie wasn't the killer, did it? The next few days were all about paperwork, lots and lots of it. I don't think most people have any idea how much ink it takes to put a murder case in the drawer, especially one of this magnitude. Not even when the FBI and the Secret Service are both arguing that justice has been done. There were endless meetings to come, and after that, public hearings. A full congressional investigation had already been promised, amid all kinds of unchecked speculation on the Hill and in the media. The country was buzzing about Tony Nicholson's client list, about the involvement of Secret Service, and even about who else might still be out there as part of Bowie's murder spree. Once the paperwork was behind me, I put in for the rest of the week off. I left the office late on Wednesday and went straight to the hospital. Nana was looking a lot more peaceful these days, like an angel, which was kind of nice and also hard to take. I stayed awake most of that night just watching her. Then Aunt Tia spelled me early on Thursday, and I managed to catch Bree still in bed when I finally got home. She was just starting to stir as I spooned up next to her.
"Do whatever you want," she whispered softly. "Just don't wake me up."
But then she laughed and turned over to kiss me good morning. Her feet and legs stayed tangled up with mine under the covers.
"All right, then, just do whatever you want to me," she said. "This is nice. Remember this?" I said.
She nodded with her forehead against mine, and I was thinking, maybe I never had to be anywhere else but here, ever again. Then the bedroom door opened. Of course it did.
"Daddy, you home?"
Ali poked his head around the corner and jumped up onto the bed before we could tell him to go away. "Little man, how many times have I told you to knock first?" I asked him.
"About a million,"
he said, and he laughed and wormed in between us anyway. Not to be outdone, Janny was there soon enough, and the two of them started chattering at us like maybe it wasn't 6:30 in the morning. Even so, it was kind of nice to be all together again. By 7, I was frying up a batch of bacon, egg, and tomato sandwiches while Bree made coffee and poured the orange juice. Janny and Ali were scanning the morning paper for my name, and I even had a little Gershwin playing in the living room. Not the bedroom with Bree, but not too shabby either. Just as I was flipping my breakfast creations out of the pan, a phone chirped from upstairs.
loud enough to be heard over the music. Everyone stopped what they were doing and looked at me, standing there with my greasy spatula in hand. "What?" I said, all wide-eyed and innocent. "I don't hear anything." That got me a chorus of cheers all around the table, and even a little pat on the butt from Bree. Whoever it was, they had the good sense not to call again. Chapter 104. A few hours later, Bree and I were back from walking the kids to school and running a few necessary errands to the drug and food stores. "Upstairs," I told her before the front door had even closed behind us. "We've got some unfinished business, you and I." She took the grocery bag out of my hands with a kiss. "I'll be right there. Don't start without me." I was halfway up the stairs when she called me back from the kitchen. "Alex!" Her voice was tense. What was it now? "Company!" When I came down, she was standing at the pass-through to the sun porch, looking out. "Guess who's here?" she said. I stepped up next to her and saw Ned Mahoney sitting in our backyard, drumming his fingers on the picnic table. "God damn it," I said. He stayed where he was, and I came out onto the porch and then down into the yard to see what was happening. "Was that you who called earlier?" I asked. Ned nodded, and before he even said a word, I realized the case wasn't over. "Do you want to come in?" "Let's talk out here," he said. I grabbed a jacket and two cups of coffee from inside, and then came back out to the picnic table. Ned gulped the coffee as I sat down. He looked exhausted. All his usual effusiveness seemed to be gone, or at least depleted. "You okay?" I asked him.
"Just a little tired," he said. "I haven't let go of this thing, Alex. I've used up all my personal days, all my vacation. Kathy's ready to kill me."
I nodded. "So is Bree, and she has a gun."
"Still, it's paid off. Boy, has it ever. I've got somebody I want you to meet. His name is Aubrey Lee Johnson. He lives down in Alabama, but he's got a custom flyreel business that brings him up to Virginia a lot."
Ned downed the last of his coffee, and I slid mine over to his side of the table. Some of the usual rev was coming back into him already.
"This guy's got a story he thinks might be important. And guess what, Alex? It is."
Chapter 105. There was no way Mahoney could get travel status for this. Even if it were his case, which it wasn't, the Bureau watches out for our tax dollars by requiring agents to use the local field offices for out-of-state interviews. Ned had already traded a few electronic communications with the Mobile office, but in the end, we decided to fly to Alabama on our own nickel. We arrived at Mobile Regional Airport late the next morning and rented a car from there. Aubrey Johnson lived on Dauphin Island, about an hour south. It was a sleepy little village, at least this time of year, and we had no trouble finding his store, Big Daddy's Fishing Tackle, on Cadillac Avenue.
"This is why we're here? Big Daddy's Fishing Tackle?" I said to Ned.
"Odd as it may seem, this is it. The end of the road. The conspiracy gets tripped up here, if we're lucky, that is.
So, let's start getting lucky."
Johnson was a tall, gregarious guy in his mid-50s, and he ushered us in like a couple of old friends, just before he double-locked up behind us. Ned had already questioned him on the phone, but Johnson repeated his story for me, how he'd been driving late one night on Route 33 in Virginia about a month ago, when a beautiful girl in a negligee stumbled out of the woods in front of his truck.
"Truth be told, I thought it was my lucky night," he said, "until I saw what kind of terrible shape she was in. Any bigger caliber on that slug in her back and she would have been dead."
Even so, the girl had insisted that Johnson keep driving, at least until they were across the state line. He finally got her to an ER just outside Winston-Salem. Still, Annie wasn't hanging around for any cops to show up, he went on. She told me she was either leaving there on foot or in my truck, so I drove her. Probably shouldn't have, but what's done is done. My wife and I have been looking after her ever since.
Her name is Annie? I asked.
I'll get to that part, he said.
Why did she come forward when she did? I asked them. All I knew was that the contact between Mr. Johnson and Mahoney had started before the names Constantine Bowie and Zeus had ever made it into the headlines.
That's a little complicated, he said. She still hasn't told us everything. We don't even know her real name. We just call her Annie to keep things simple. When I tried putting out some feelers, there wasn't much I could say, so I don't think people took me too seriously, at least not until Agent Mahoney here called me back. He was following up on a call I made to the FBI field office in Mobile.
And where is she now, Aubrey? Ned asked.
Not far.
Johnson took a set of keys off the counter.
I'll let her speak for herself, but I will tell you this much. That fellow they're calling Zeus on the news? She says you all got the wrong man. She isn't Annie, and he isn't Zeus.
Chapter 106. Johnson led us back through the village in his truck, almost to the mainland bridge. Then he turned off and parked at the Dolphin Island Marina. Fewer than half of the slips were occupied, and the office and snack shack on the waterfront both looked closed and shuttered for the season. We followed him up one of the three long docks to a sport fishing boat called the May. A heavyset woman, presumably Mrs. Johnson, was waiting on the deck. She looked at us a lot more skeptically than her husband had.
"This them?" she said. "You know it is, May. Let's go."
She didn't move.
"This girl's been through a living hell. You understand me? You need to go easy with her."
I had no quarrel with the attitude, actually. I was grateful for it. We assured Mrs. Johnson that we'd be good with the girl, and then followed her down to the little cabin below deck. Annie was sitting in the crook of the dining banquette, looking drawn and nervous. Even so, she was an obviously beautiful girl, with the kind of China doll features that Tony Nicholson seemed to have favored for Blacksmith Farms. Her cargo pants and baggy pink sweatshirt were either borrowed or thrift shop specials, and she had a gray canvas sling on her right arm. She was huddled over, and when she moved, I could see that her back, where she'd been shot, still hurt quite a bit. Mahoney started with introductions and asked if she was willing to give us her name.
"It's Hannah," she said, tentatively at first. "Hannah Willis. Is that something you can help me with? Becoming somebody else? Witness protection, or whatever it is you use these days."
Ned explained that the U.S. Attorney's Office would decide if she even needed to testify, but if so, then yes, she was a perfect candidate for WITSEC. In the meantime, he assured her, we wouldn't record anything that she had to tell us. "Let's start with what happened to you," I said, "the night Aubrey picked you up in his truck." She nodded slowly, mustering the memory, or maybe just the will to tell it. May Johnson sat next to her, holding her hand the whole time.
"It was supposed to be some kind of private party at Blacksmith," Hannah said. "We didn't know anything except the client code name. Zeus. You think maybe he has a high opinion of himself? Code name is a god."
"Was this party held in the apartment over the carriage barn?" I asked.
"That's right." She seemed surprised that I already knew. "I'd never been up there before. I knew the pay was better."
"When you say we," Ned asked, "how many of you were there with Zeus?"
"Just me and one other girl, Nicole," she said. "Although I doubt that was her real name.
It also wasn't the first time I'd heard it used in a conversation like this. I could feel my heart thumping as I reached into my pocket and took out the picture of Caroline that I'd been carrying with me from the start of this terrible, unholy mess. "Is this her, Hannah?" I asked. She nodded, and the tears started to come.
"Yes, sir. That's the girl who died. That's Nicole."
Chapter 107. I listened carefully, filtering my rage away from the information Hannah was giving us about Caroline's murder and her own terrible ordeal at Blacksmith Farms. She described how Zeus had handcuffed them to the bed, then used his fists and his teeth, focusing more on Caroline than on her, for reasons she couldn't explain even now. By the time he had raped both women, she said, Nicole was barely conscious, and the mattress cover on the bed was slick with blood. He left soon after that, and Hannah had begun to hope the worst of it might be over, until two men came in to take them away. One was tall and blonde, the other Hispanic and stocky. That's when she understood what was coming next, on account of what had happened with Zeus, on account of what she and Caroline knew about him.
They worked quickly, like they'd done it before. Cleaned up his mess, Hannah said. I can still see the two of them, the bored look on their faces.
Both girls were then carried down and put in the trunk of a car. Hannah told us how she held Caroline's hand there in the dark and tried to keep her talking for as long as possible. Eventually, though, Caroline stopped answering. By the time they got where they were going and the trunk opened again, she was dead. They were in the woods at a cabin of some kind. A third man was there, and he seemed to take over for the other two. The only light on them was his lantern, and he held it up to Hannah's face, examining her as though she were a piece of meat. Then he set it on the ground to have a closer look at Caroline, to make sure she was dead. That's when Hannah decided she had nothing left to lose, since they would surely kill her too. She kicked the lantern over and ran for the woods. The three men came after her, of course, and there were gunshots, including the one that lodged in her back. Somehow, she managed to keep going. It was nothing she could explain at this point, or even remember very clearly, right up until she came out on the road and saw the oncoming headlights of Aubrey Johnson's pickup truck. Everything about the story lined up with what I already knew. The indications of bite marks on Caroline's remains, the cabin in the woods, the description of the two men with the car. There was only one question still hanging. The question. Who was he, Hannah? Who was Zeus? How did you know who he was?
We knew because he showed us his face. He lifted his terrible mask and said it didn't matter if Caroline and I saw him.
Hannah, I said next, who is he? Who is Zeus? And even then, with everything else I knew about this case, her answer still floored me.
Chapter 108. The Kennedy Center's grand foyer was lit up like a Macy's Christmas window for the spectacle that was the annual honors reception. Medals had been awarded to five of the entertainment industry's best and brightest tonight, and half of L.A. seemed to be here, rubbing elbows with half of D.C. In Washington terms, there was no other night quite like this one. No night was more star-filled. For Teddy, it was definitely a night to celebrate. Ask any of these glitterati about the week's headlines, and 9 out of 10 would have told the same story. Zeus was dead. A very bad man had done terrible things, and he'd paid the ultimate price for his indiscretions. It was the stuff of classics. And like any good fairy tale, it was a lie, only loosely based on truth. In fact, Zeus was right here among them. enjoying the lobster cocktail and champagne just like anyone else. Well, not exactly like anyone else. Teddy's was a world where even the power elite kissed his butt on a regular basis, and people paid good money just to be in the same room with him. If that wasn't a privilege worth preserving, he didn't know what was. Still, there was the matter of the urges to screw beautiful girls, to see them in pain, to kill. Whether or not he could keep the urges in check now was yet to be seen, but the timing and the opportunity to leave it all behind could not have been better. He was in the clear now. He'd been given a second chance. So Teddy pushed all those hot thoughts way to the back of his mind, where they belonged for now, and resumed working the room as only he could. This was pure Teddy. Teddy at his best. Teddy in his element. He chatted briefly with Meryl Streep and John McLaughlin at the bar, complimented the House Speaker on his recent Meet the Press slam dunk interview, congratulated Patti LuPone, one of the night's honorees, for all of her stunning achievements, whatever they might have been, and he kept moving, kept moving, kept moving, never staying too long in the same place, never wearing out a welcome, never revealing a thing about himself. That was the beauty and allure of the cocktail hour. Eventually, he came upon Maggie in the Hall of Nations, schmoozing the new Democratic governor from Georgia and his greyhound-faced wife, whose name Teddy could never remember. "Speak of the devil," Maggie hooked her arm into his. "Hello, darling. We were just talking about you, Douglas, Charlotte, and I." "Hello, Doug, Charlotte. All good things, I hope," he said, and the others laughed as though it were expected of them, which it was.
"Well, your wife was just telling us you're quite the equestrian," the governor said.
"Ah," Teddy answered, "my little-known secret. I have so few these days. I don't like those to get out."
"Well, we'll have to have you down to the farm sometime. We got some beautiful trails around our summer place."
"That sounds absolutely terrific, the farm," he said, telling the kind of lie that never hurt anyone. "And the president and I will have to have you overnight at the White House one of these days." He looked over at Maggie, smiling placidly. "Isn't that right, sweetheart?"
Chapter 109. Driving in from the airport that night, Ned Mahoney and I were part of an emergency conference call that had been pulled together while we were still in the air. Theodore Teddy Vance was known to be with his wife, the President of the United States, at the Kennedy Center Honors. We had him. The question on the table was how to proceed. Most of the resistance was from Secret Service, who ironically had the least say in this decision, except maybe for me. Their Deputy Director of Investigations, Angela Reardon, was doing most of the talking.
"We're certainly not going to put up with any of this habeas corpus crap, understand? This is the first gentleman of the United States we're talking about. If the Bureau even thinks about crossing our security line, he'll be gone before anyone gets inside the building. Do I need to repeat myself?"
"We have no issue with that, Angela." This was Luke Hamill, the Bureau's assistant director in charge on the case before it got moved to Charlottesville. We also had the FBI director himself, Ron Burns, listening in with a few of their people from legal. "No one's talking arrest yet," Hamill went on. "We just want to speak with him. He's a person of interest at this point."
"Then there's no reason it can't wait until tomorrow."
I recognized the slight accent of Vance's personal attorney, Raj Doshi, who was driving in from Maryland as we spoke. "Actually, there's a very good reason," I said. "People have already died under this cover-up. Not doing anything tonight means risking more lives, and the fact that we're having this conversation only increases that risk."
"Excuse me, Detective Cross, was it?" Reardon asked. "We're not going to make tactical decisions here based on your gut feelings or your paranoia."
"With all due respect, you have no idea if I'm being paranoid or not," I said. I didn't want to put too fine a point on it, but Ned Mahoney and I were holding more cards here than anyone else on the call. Ultimately,
I think Reardon recognized her lack of options, and she agreed to pull Vance in for questioning. When Doshi insisted the interview take place off-site, the FBI had no objection to the demand. They quickly settled on the Eisenhower building. "This is Cross again," I said into the speaker. "Can I assume Dan Cormorant is already on duty at the Kennedy Center?" "Why do you want to know?" It was Agent Silo Ridge this time. I hadn't even realized he was on the line. "Cormorant's been my Secret Service contact on Zeus," I said. "I'd be surprised if he didn't have information we could use." The full truth was that I had some questions of my own for Cormorant, and I wanted to see him face to face before I said anything I might regret later. They never answered me, but it didn't matter. I'd find out soon enough. I could see the Kennedy Center looming straight ahead. Chapter 110. There had probably never been a takedown like this one. Not in the annals of police history. Definitely not in my police history. We convened on the Kennedy Center's River Terrace, just outside the Grand Foyer, where the party was in full swing. I'd already seen a handful of movie stars floating by the 60-foot-high windows, but as yet, there was no sign of Teddy Vance. No sign of Zeus. Luke Hamill from the Bureau had brought another senior agent with him, James Walsh, whom I didn't recognize and didn't think I'd met before. My old boss, Ron Burns, was keeping his distance on this one, but he'd also made sure there was a place here for me and Mahoney. I'd return the favor someday if I could. From Secret Service, we had Reardon and Ridge in addition to the operational team already on site. That meant agents in tuxes paired up on all the doors, a heavy MPD presence down at street level, and a chopper and EMTs on standby, all standard for any presidential event. Other than the White House, there wasn't a more secure building in Washington tonight. I could feel the tension spreading everywhere in my body. Once we were in place, Reardon put the center on a temporary crash condition. No one in or out until the first gentleman was away. Next, traffic was routed away from the building. A lot of drivers were about to be seriously inconvenienced, but that was the least of our problems right now. The first gentleman was in all probability a murderer. Less than a minute passed before Dan Cormorant stepped outside in his tux. He reported straight to Angela Reardon and ignored everyone else. "Ma'am, we're good to go inside." "All right. I want a nice, quiet exit on this. Understood, Dan? Montana will come out this way, and we'll proceed to the EEOB. "Yes, ma'am." He caught me staring at him as he turned to go. I didn't know how much Cormorant had already been told, but my presence spoke for itself. He'd have to know what this was about. Still, I couldn't get a read on him, and he was already headed back in, radioing orders into his cuff. "This is Cormorant. I need Montana detail ready to move, on my lead. Command, we're going to need full transport from the North Plaza, immediately." On instinct, I leaned over and spoke quietly to Agent Ridge. "You should go in with him," I said. He didn't look at me. "Thanks for the tip, Detective." "I'm serious," I told him. But he put a hand out to keep me back, more like a straight arm. "Cross, someday you're going to be king of the world, but in the meantime, just keep your damn shirt on." I was finding that hard to do. I didn't like the scenario one bit, not if Theodore Vance really was our killer. Chapter 111.
Something was wrong. Teddy could feel the tension coming off Cormorant before the Secret Service agent even spoke into his ear. "Excuse me, sir. Would you come with me, please? It's kind of important." Maggie saw it too and knew exactly how to respond. She smiled her best big party smile. "Don't keep him long now, Dan, okay?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Governor, hold that thought," Teddy told his and Maggie's guest. "I'll be right back." Then, not knowing quite why, he leaned in and kissed his wife on the cheek. "I love you, darling," he he whispered, and she winked back. Sweet Maggie. The world would probably never know how good this woman could be. Not that he really loved her exactly, or could even tell himself what that was supposed to feel like. But it worked. They worked. However much about him she would never know, it couldn't erase what was true between them. Some of the parts and all that. Complicated. Like all relationships. He double-stepped to come alongside the agent as they moved across the foyer. What's going on, Dan? Sir, I need you to stay calm, Cormorant said. The FBI have a few questions for you. They're waiting outside to follow us to the EEOB. Teddy stopped short. Hang on a second. Are you trying... He cocked his head to one side and smiled at a couple of passing gawkers. Then he turned back to the room. Are you trying to give me a fucking heart attack here? Sir, I know what I'm doing. I really do. I need you to trust me. Trust you? You're walking me right into them. Cormorant shoved his radio hand into his pocket and his voice dropped to a fierce whisper. Haven't I proven anything to you by now? For God's sake, Teddy, get it together. They just want to ask you some questions. Why don't I believe that, Dan? This is bad. This is very bad, isn't it? Listen to me. The agent's eyes traveled to the farthest exit and back again. The only viable way out of this is straight through those doors. We either keep moving or they're coming in after you. There's nowhere to run, Teddy. If they come in here, it will be an embarrassment for the president. He could see them now, a collection of dark suits out on the river terrace, including that MPD detective who had been dogging him, Alex Cross, the one who should have been dead and disposed of a long time ago. Sir, we have to go. Don't rush me, goddammit. Are you forgetting? I'm Teddy Vance. Teddy straightened his tie and took a fluted glass off a passing waiter's tray. It was a struggle not to down it all at once. Just a swallow for now, and another casual smile for the room, while the blood pounded in his ears. All right, he said. Let's do this. I can certainly answer a few of their questions.
Chapter 112. Dan Cormorant was smooth and efficient. I'll give him that much. He disappeared into the grand foyer and reappeared about 45 seconds later with Theodore Vance at his side. Everything seemed to be right on track so far. Then Vance stopped before they actually reached the door. He turned to say something to the Secret Service agent. Cormorant pocketed his mic. This wasn't good. Not good at all. Next to me, Angela Reardon cupped a palm over her earpiece, trying to hear. Dan, what are you doing? He didn't respond. Cormorant, keep it moving. Dan, get Montana out of there now, said Reardon. She motioned to Agent Ridge that he should go in, but then pulled him back when Vance turned on his own and started to come our way. He was looking right at us now. Was he Zeus? According to Hannah Willis, he was, and I believed her. Cormorant followed a step behind, with three other members of the spousal detail just ahead and on either side of the first gentleman. An agent at the door pushed it open and stepped out first, then held it for Vance to come through. The next happened in a blink. One of those instants that comes and goes but is photographed in the mind, then never, ever forgotten. Cormorant was mostly obscured behind Vance, and I just saw the back of his jacket flip up. My Glock came out an instant later, but already it was too late. The .357 rose in Cormorant's hand, and he fired into the back of Theodore Vance's head. Vance flew forward and landed hard on the cement outside. Chaos followed, incomprehension, terror, disbelief. Almost immediately, Cormorant took some number of simultaneous shots from the agents around him. Within seconds, he was down too, and the place had erupted into sheer madness. Hundreds of people were screaming and trying to run for the exits. Right away, the foyer drapes started to close, cutting off the scene of the shootings. As they did, I spotted a tight cluster of Secret Service agents, running with what I assumed was the president, toward whatever nearest hard room they had set up. I wondered if she knew her husband had been shot. Reardon was shouting into her radio, trying to be heard over the other noise.
Shots fired! Montana is down! I repeat, Montana is down! We need an advanced life support team to the River Terrace, north side, now!
Teddy Vance's detail had formed two circles around him, one close on the ground, and the other facing out, weapons drawn. Mahoney and I spread out as part of a wider perimeter. Already, the press corps was pushing in at the edges, frantic to get their stories, to get anything. Cops were everywhere. Sirens were blaring in the street, and there was deafening shouting coming from all sides, all at once. It was too early for official theories, but I thought I knew what we'd just witnessed. Cormorant was a veteran agent, a patriot, at least in his own mind. He waited for Teddy Vance to clear the building, then fired one lethal bullet, knowing he'd take kill shots in return. It was a suicide as much as an assassination, the last act in a bloody cover-up, and in Agent Cormorant's own way, the last piece of damage control he could offer his president. Chapter 113. Shaken and exhausted, I got home around 4:30 that morning. Maybe the last of my vampire hours for a while. If Bree wasn't already up, I was going to wake her and tell her what had happened. But she wasn't even there. Bree wasn't anywhere in the house. I realized this as soon as I saw Aunt Tia's big knitting bag on the floor by the kitchen table. Tia had come to stay with the kids, and Saint Bree had gone to cover my overnight at the hospital. Of course she had. She wouldn't have wanted Nana to be alone any more than I did. I almost got back in the car, but it made more sense to spell Bree first thing in the morning and let Tia go home then. We were stretched thin as it was. So I went upstairs and lay on top of the covers, wide awake and buzzing with everything that had happened, not just tonight, but in the past few weeks. The scope of it all was going to reverberate for months, even years, I was sure. We still didn't know how many others like Caroline there'd been, and maybe never would. Nor did we know the extent of the cover-up for Zeus, or who had been doing the covering. Theodore Vance had been a successful and very rich businessman on his own. He'd had the resources to do whatever he wished or fantasized about. Apparently, that's exactly what he had done. Later in the day, I'd have to call my sister-in-law, Michelle. I'd also have to decide how much of her daughter's story I was going to tell her. Some of the details had no place in a mother's memory. Sometimes I wonder about the place they have in mine. It hadn't been half an hour since I'd gotten home, if that, when the phone rang out in the hall. I jumped up to catch it before a third ring. Considering the events of the past 24 hours, it might have been any number of people looking for me. "Alex Cross," I answered in a whisper. And just like that, life changed again.
"Alex, it's Zadie Mitchell calling from the hospital. How soon can you get over here?"
Chapter 114. I ran. I ran out to the car in the driveway. I ran my siren all the way to St. Anthony's, and I ran up four flights of stairs to Nana's room. When I came in, Bree was there with tears streaming down her face, and next to her, in the bed, with eyes like slits but open, was Nana Mama. Regina Hope Cross, the toughest person I've ever known in my life, wasn't done with us yet. Her voice was just a crackle, static almost, but it nearly bowled me over.
"What took you so long?" she said. "I'm back."
"Yes, you are." I was beaming when I knelt down to kiss her as gently as I could. She still had two IVs and the AV line to her heart, but the vent and feeding tubes were off,
and it was like seeing someone I hadn't laid eyes on for weeks and weeks.
"What did I miss?" she asked.
"Nothing much. Hardly a thing. The world stopped spinning without you."
"Very funny," she said, although I was kind of serious. Everything else could wait.
Zadie and one of the cardiologists, Dr. Stieg, were in the room monitoring Nana's condition.
"Regina's going to need what we call an LVAD, the doctor said. "A left ventricle assist device. It's the next best thing to a transplant, and it'll help get her home sooner rather than later." He put a hand on Nana's shoulder and spoke up a little. "Looking forward to anything in particular, Regina?" She nodded groggily.
"To not being dead yet," she said, and I laughed with everyone else.
Her eyes fluttered closed again.
"She'll be in and out for at least a few days," Stieg said. "Nothing to worry about."
He took a few more minutes to go over the care plan with Bree and me, and then gave us some time alone in the room. As we sat together by the bed, Bree told me she'd seen the overnight news. All the major channels were broadcasting live from the Kennedy Center, the White House, and the Vance's home in Philadelphia. Already, a kind of awkward mourning had begun and was spreading around the country.
"So, is that really it?" Bree asked. "Is it over?"
"Yeah," I said, thinking more about Nana than about Teddy Vance. "As much as anything ever is, Zeus is dead. That much we know for sure."
Epilogue. Phoenix Rising. Chapter 115. The holiday season flew by this year, and I'm not kidding. Damon came home for Christmas break, and by New Year's Eve, Nana was mobile enough to do a whole crown roast for the family, with a little help from her friends. It was a perfect way to say goodbye to the year, just the six of us, even if Ali and Nana didn't quite make it to midnight. New Year's Day started quietly, too. I listened to a few chapters of Ha Jin's A Free Life with Nana in her room, made brunch for the kids, and then asked Bree if she'd take a drive with me in the afternoon.
"A drive in the country would be perfect," she said. "Good idea. I'm in."
It was just below freezing out, but perfectly climate-controlled inside the car. I put on some John Legend, pointed north, and watched the world sail by for an hour or so. Bree didn't even notice where we were headed until I got off 270 in Maryland.
"Oh, goody."
"Oh, goody?"
"You heard me. Oh, goody. Goody, goody gumdrops. I love this place."
Catoctin Mountain Park is something of a sentimental favorite for us. It was the first place Bree and I ever went away together, and we'd gone camping there a few times since, with the kids and just the two of us. It's beautiful year-round and closed on New Year's Day, as it turned out.
"No big deal, Alex," Bree said. "It's a beautiful drive here anyway."
I pulled over at the big stone gate outside the main entrance and turned off the car's engine.
"Let's go for our walk."
"What are they going to do? Arrest us?"
Chapter 116. A few minutes later, Bree and I had the Cunningham Falls Trail all to ourselves, as alone as we were going to get in the course of an afternoon. The snow was fresh. The sky was bright blue, one of nature's perfect days.
"Got any resolutions?" I asked her.
"Sure,"
she said. "Work too much, stop going to the gym, and eat until I'm fat. How about you?"
"I'm going to stop recycling."
"Good plan."
"Maybe spend a little less time with the kids."
"Definitely that. Great idea."
"And I want to see if I can't get the woman I love to marry me."
Bree stopped short. I would have hoped for no less. I took advantage of the moment and pulled the ring out of my pocket.
"It was Nana's," I said. "She'd like you to have it too."
Oh, my God.
Bree was smiling and shaking her head. I couldn't quite read the expression.
Alex, so much has just gone down in your life. Are you sure this is the right time for you?
If this were some other woman, I might have thought it was code for letting me down easy. But this was Bree, and she doesn't do code. Bree, do you remember the night of my birthday? I asked her.
Sure,
she said, a little confused. When everything started, all the gunk. That's the night you first heard about Caroline. And up until that phone call from Davies, it was supposed to be the night I asked you to marry me. So, if we can't have that back, I'd say right now is just about perfect. Will you marry me, Bree? I love you so much, I can't stand it. The wind kicked up, and she reached inside my coat to put her arms around me. Then we kissed for a long time.
I love you too, Bree whispered. Then, yes, Alex, she finally said. I do love you so much. Yes to you. Yes to your amazing family.
Our amazing family, I said, and kissed her again. She nodded close in against me, shutting out the cold.
Yes to all of it.
Chapter 117. We celebrated again that night, Szechuan takeout this time, and then a bottle of champagne with Samson and Billy over at the house to hear the big news. No one could have been more excited than I was, but Samson and Billy came pretty close. I didn't hear a single crack about how crazy Bree was for marrying me. Much later, we were lying in bed, just Bree and me, that is, and already talking about a summer wedding, when my cell phone rang in the nightstand. No, no, no. I pulled a pillow over my head. This is my New Year's resolution. No more phones, maybe ever. We were both due back at work the next morning, but that wasn't for another 8 hours. Sweetie, Bree climbed over me to take the phone out of the drawer. I'm marrying a cop. Cops answer their calls. Get over it. She handed it to me with another kiss and rolled off again. Alex Cross, I said.
I wanted to be among the first to congratulate you, Alex. You and Bree. Oh, what a happy ending this is.
I sat up. The voice wasn't just familiar. It was a stone-cold live nightmare. Most of the world knew Kyle Craig as the mastermind. I knew him as an old friend who was now my worst enemy. Kyle, why are you really calling me?
I'm bored, Alex. Nobody plays with me the way you do. Nobody knows me like you do. It might be a good time for some more fun. Just the two of us.
I don't think we define that word in the same way, I said. He laughed softly.
Oh, I'm sure you're right. Besides, even I can see you need a little break after Zeus. Consider it my wedding present to you. Just don't get too comfortable, my friend. Nothing lasts forever. But then you already knew that, didn't you? All my best wishes to Bree, to Nana. And, of course, the kids. Oh, and Alex, here's to fun.
This has been an Hachette audio production of I, Alex Cross, written by James Patterson, read by Tim Kaine and Michael Cerveris, executive producer Michelle McGonigal. Produced and directed by Kevin Thompson. Recorded by Tommy Herron at Hachette Audio Studios. Edited by Pete Pantelis. And mixed and mastered at Merlin Music, New York City. I, Alex Cross,
is also available in print from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 2009 by James Patterson. Audio production copyright 2009 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this publication may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the written permission of the publisher. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.